Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 95 for Tuesday, April 5th, 2011. I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
We have three stories to chat about this week. First, Righthaven sues Eric Gardner over an article he wrote for Ars Technica. Second, Amazon is launching a streaming music player in the cloud. And finally, two parents file a lawsuit against Facebook to have photographs removed of their daughter. So let's get started. Last Friday, that is March 26th, a lawsuit was filed against Eric Gardner, who is a lawyer and a blogger at The Hollywood Reporter, ESQ blog. He was sued by Righthaven for copyright infringement. And if you've heard the name Righthaven a lot recently, it's probably because a number of their copyright lawsuits have been the subject of negative media attention. In the past, it's been alleged that Righthaven has been purchasing the copyright interests associated with news articles that appear in newspapers like the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Then, lawsuits are filed against defendants, many of whom happen to be small website owners and bloggers, for using copyrighted elements from newspaper articles on their websites and blogs. Now, after the lawsuits are filed, it's said that the defendant, Righthaven, reaches out to them and they send them some sort of offer letter, an offer letter to settle the case for several thousand dollars, and in most cases that's arguably cheaper than going to court and using a fair use defense. So keeping this in mind, Eric Gardner, the defendant in this week's story, wrote a freelance article for Ars Technica last December that described one of these Righthaven lawsuits. And actually, I think it was a case that we covered on our show previously that involved the Drudge Report, which had been sued for using a photograph of a TSA agent doing a pat-down at an airport. So in the Ars Technica article, Eric Gardner was discussing the merits of the lawsuit and criticizing Righthaven, describing their reputation, and I'm quoting here, as a world-class copyright troll. And in addition, Gardner had reposted the photograph and some accompanying text that the Drudge Report had used that had become the basis of the Drudge Report lawsuit, just to show readers, I think, what the use was like that led to the lawsuit. And here's the kicker, though, that the photograph that Gardner was using wasn't actually the original. It was a grainy black and white image that looked like it had been scanned into a computer. I'd say one that closely resembles what you might find attached as an exhibit to a court filing. So last week, Righthaven sued Gardner personally, not Ars Technica, for using this image in this December post on Ars Technica. This was a news article describing another Righthaven lawsuit. And after this news broke, Ars Technica called Righthaven up and asked what the deal was, and they responded by saying it was a clerical mistake and that they had already voluntarily dismissed the lawsuit with prejudice. Righthaven also noted that this was the first time in over 200 of their lawsuits that they had voluntarily dismissed a case. So, a few thoughts before I throw this over to our panel of wolf-like lawyers. First, I think that the Ars Technica article is probably a textbook example of fair use. So we're talking about a news article that's covering a lawsuit that's within the public's interest. The photograph that's at issue here isn't even the original photograph. It's a black and white image scan depicting its association with the Drudge Report lawsuit. And I'd bet a pretty penny it was the same one that was attached as an exhibit to the Drudge Report lawsuit filing. Because the article is describing the lawsuit and Drudge's use of the photo, it's difficult to get away from the fact that the Ars Technica usage of the photo falls into news, commentary, and criticism, which are the explicitly mentioned in the Copyright Act under the fair use provision as examples of fair use. So, throwing this over to the panel now, what do you guys think, and was there anything else that's interesting about this lawsuit?
It was interesting how quickly it was reported on and then withdrawn, although even the withdrawal took a little longer than I think Righthaven intended, because first they filed a motion to dismiss the suit without prejudice to refiling, and then later amended that filing to say that they were dismissing it with prejudice, which means that they would be prevented legally from refiling the case against Eric Gardner for this particular infringement ever again.
Right, and one thing we discussed in our email thread that caused us some initial confusion was that Eric Gardner was sued personally and it wasn't Ars Technica. Have you guys come up with any theories of why that might be the case?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head except that the person who was filing the lawsuit knew that Ars Technica was part of Condé Nast and thought that that would be a terrible idea to sue Condé Nast. But, I mean, then you got to wonder, why did they go after a freelancer?
Would it matter that he's a freelancer?
I don't think so. We're talking about a Condé Nast property. Ars Technica is owned by Condé Nast, and it's a part of a larger network of news sites. So usually when you have a freelance relationship, the freelancer is assigning all of his copyrights over to the organization who's doing the publishing. So for our purposes, I think we can assume that there was some sort of assignment of Eric Gardner's copyright in his article, and so the onus would seem to fall on Ars Technica. What's baffling me about this is Ars Technica here would be the one with the deep pockets, and if there was anyone that would be likely to settle early, it would seem to be Ars Technica. So the only other theory I've come up with on this is that as Condé Nast has a DMCA policy on their website, it might be the case that the Righthaven lawyers think that there would be a duty to notify under the DMCA takedown provisions, and they wanted to get around that for some reason. And I don't, it's not really clear why, but this might be part of their 1-2 punch that they do. In the past, when they've sued other defendants for reposting portions of these newspaper articles, they just tend to sue them out of the blue, no warning, there's no cease and desist letter that's ever sent, and you don't have to in those cases where there isn't a DMCA takedown notice. Then they follow up with this offer to settle, and maybe that has some sort of psychological effect, I don't know. That could be the case, and that they wanted to have the same effect here, that's possible, but it's also possible that they could have thought if they had sued Ars Technica, there would have been some duty to notify under their DMCA takedown notice at the bottom of the website.
But I don't think the DMCA would actually apply to a company that was paying, in this case, Eric Gardner, to post that information. You know, if they're paying him for writing the article, I don't think, you know, this qualifies as user-generated content that they would be protected against under the DMCA.
Absolutely. That's the baffling part about this, is that the safe harbor probably wouldn't apply, but I guess the question in my mind is if separately that the takedown notice provisions would apply if a online service provider, which is the terminology that the DMCA uses, does in fact have a registered DMCA notice listed at the bottom of the site. So before being able to sue Ars Technica personally, regardless if the safe harbor would apply to them or not, maybe there is a duty under the statute to send a DMCA takedown notice first. It sounds silly though. It seems totally counterintuitive to the whole purpose of the safe harbor and the DMCA.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not buying that that's an explanation, but that's not your fault. I think that's Righthaven's fault for filing a ridiculous lawsuit in the first place. You know, and when they were asked for an explanation about this, they said that it was a clerical error, which, as the fine folks on This Week in Law pointed out, is kind of a ridiculous thing to say, because a lawsuit has to be signed by an attorney, and under the federal rules of civil procedure, that attorney is attesting to the fact that, you know, everything in that lawsuit is, to the best of their knowledge, correct. So it's the kind of thing that really shouldn't be subject to clerical errors. Clerical errors are what happen when you've got, you know, a production line, not when you're filing lawsuits against individuals.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to clerical error your way to a lawsuit.
So I just wonder, who then is reviewing or trying to flag people as possible defendants for Righthaven suits? Is it interns or something? I mean, this case to me, like, just looking at the way that the article was posted, and as far as I know, this was the only article that, or the only place that Eric Gardner had posted the article was at Ars Technica. It seems such a classic example of fair use that the lawsuit almost has no merit. So what then were the attorneys thinking when they reviewed this? Did they just sort of sign off on something that someone else had put together? And who exactly is flagging the possible defendants?
And my guess is they've got a paralegal, or, you know, maybe just somebody who works in the office going around the internet looking for mentions of Righthaven, or the, you know, this TSA picture from the Denver Post that was, you know, the subject of this lawsuit. The person punches in, you know, then goes through, finds all of the relevant information for the lawsuit, punches in, and gives it to an attorney who signs. The attorney, you know, inappropriately signs it without really looking at it and giving a good investigation. You know, one interesting thing that I would have liked to see in this case, but is not going to happen, is the copyright statute provides for attorney's fees and some some measure of damages for the prevailing party in a copyright suit. Would have been interesting to see Eric Gardner try to go after Righthaven for whatever fees, if any, he incurred in the, very brief defense of this lawsuit. But my guess is, for one, there's the courts tend to be reluctant to grant fees in cases that are dismissed, as opposed to cases that are adjudicated in favor of one party or another. And secondly, I mean, it's going to be difficult to say, I incurred X hundreds or thousands of dollars in legal fees in the, one day between when I was served process in this case and when I, when it was dismissed.
So it's actually interesting you brought up the 512F provision, which is if you where you can get in trouble if you send a takedown notice in bad faith. That might be one of the provisions that would give Righthaven some cause to stop and think about why you wouldn't want to send a DMCA takedown notice in the first place, because if you sent a DMCA takedown notice, then you have to comply with 512F, or at least it's possible that someone could bring a lawsuit against you under 512F for sending a notice in bad faith. And that could then lead to damages just for sending the notice.
Although, that's what those damages are and when those damages start accruing are kind of subject of the Lentz case right now, the dancing baby case. And the case law about that is still kind of up in the air as to what constitutes damage and when you can actually get it.
Yeah, there's only been a handful of cases which even discuss that particular provision, so that would probably be an unclear path as well. Any other final thoughts on this?
All set here.
I'm all set, so I'll just plow right into the next case, which is that Amazon this past week, announced Cloudflare. It was tied with their cloud drive service. Their cloud drive service is essentially like a 5 GB free Dropbox-style hard drive where you can store information, store whatever files you like on the cloud. Now, if you store any compatible MP3 files on your cloud drive, you also get access to something called Cloudflare, which allows you to stream that information, stream those MP3s through either any browser or well, currently I think only Android devices have an app that you can stream, but one can presume that eventually there'll be a iPhone app that will let you do this too. And additionally, if you buy any MP3s on Amazon.com, they'll be automatically included in your cloud drive without counting against your 5 GB or however much you choose to have limit. Amazon has gone on the record, so I've actually heard conflicting reports. I've first heard Amazon saying, you know what, the reason why we didn't ask for licenses before we did this is because we don't need licenses. It's your music, you can store it, you have it in the form of an MP3 and you can store it and play it from wherever you want. Which I think is a bold move. I've also heard reports of Amazon, now that they've released it, going to the record companies and saying, okay, listen, we released this, we'd be happy to negotiate some sort of reasonable license with you. So there are both reports of Amazon, with bravado saying, we don't need licenses, and there have also been stories of Amazon now going to try to negotiate licenses. First off, have you guys heard the same kind of two sides of this story, or have you only been hearing one or the other?
Oh, definitely. I've been hearing conflicting reports also.
Okay, and I guess the follow-up question is, does Amazon need a license to do Cloudflare?
Well, let's take Amazon out of the picture for a second and say I have a CD that I purchased, and I rip the CD and put the music on my iPod. Do I need a license?
I don't think you do. I think the record company may say different.
Okay, and now let's say I put, instead of on my iPod, I put it on my Dropbox, and then I stream it to my iPhone.
You can stream it to your iPhone from a Dropbox?
Yes, you can.
I didn't know that.
It's pretty awesome.
I okay. I'll keep that in mind in the future. And yeah, that again, I don't think you need a license for that, but there's a big difference between a person independently doing this and, well, at least the record companies would say there's a big difference between somebody independently doing this and a company setting this up. And
What?
providing all of the services and all of the linkings.
Only if it's infringement. Like, if it's not infringement, it doesn't matter who does it. Like the difference exists if it's in, like if Amazon is inducing people to infringe by providing the service and making it easy to do so. But that's only inducement if it's infringement. If what I do with Dropbox isn't infringement, then Amazon's, I don't really see any distinction between that and someone having their own personal Dropbox. And if Dropbox isn't getting sued for infringement, then why is Amazon? Potentially.
Because Amazon's making it a lot clearer and a lot easier.
Right, but if it's not infringement, then, I mean, it
I mean,
doesn't
and
matter
to
if
be
it's
clear,
easy to
Amazon
do.
hasn't been, sorry to interrupt, Amazon has not been
No,
sued
go
by anyone yet. It's just a question
Yeah.
as to whether or not, Amazon is likely to get sued eventually.
I think it comes down to what are the licensing terms that the record companies give Amazon before they in turn resell those MP3s to their customers. And that's hard for us to determine because, of course, we don't have the contracts in front of us. And as far as I know, that's not something that Amazon really publishes, or leaks to the public. But I guess it would seem if the license agreements between the record labels and Amazon are free of any encumbrances, it's at least possible that they would not need new licenses in order to make something like this happen. I just highly doubt, though, that that's the case.
Well, let's walk through why it would or wouldn't be infringement.
Because, so my argument would be Amazon has the right to sell these licenses to people, but then Amazon, once they sell the license, doesn't have, and again, this is wholly dependent on what Amazon's actual agreement is, does Amazon have the authority under their existing license to transmit a copy of the, to make a copy of the music and to put a copy of that music on, this person's cloud drive? And then do they have the right to stream that music, that copy to somebody? Corollary to that is streaming that copy a public performance if it's one copy streaming to one person? The MP3.com case from a while back established that streaming one copy to multiple people is a public performance, but is streaming one copy to one person and a different copy of the same song to another person a public performance?
I would argue no.
But how is that a substantial difference? If you're streaming one copy of a song to multiple people, that's a public performance, but if you've got 100 copies of that song streaming to 100 people, that's not a public performance of the work. It's the work we're concerned about, it's not the copy of the work.
Right, but you have the license to s you have a license to perform that work to one person, right?
I'm we're,
The
at this
person
point, we're
owning the
totally
work does.
speculating as to what the license is. Yeah, well, okay, if the person owning the license has a right to listen to the music, does
Right, that's what you're
Amazon's.
purchasing when you're purchasing an MP3.
Right, but Amazon isn't purchasing the right to stream that to you.
Yeah, but the user who bought the MP3 off of Amazon is, and the user can stream it wherever the hell he wants on Amazon or Dropbox. It shouldn't matter whether it's on Dropbox or on Amazon. Like, the streaming platform doesn't need a license to stream something I have a license to listen to.
It doesn't? You've got
No.
a license to watch, I don't know, God, what's Mad Men on your Comcast TV set. You're saying that if you wanted to take that episode of Mad Men, transmit it, store it as a make it a, I don't know, a M4V or some sort of video file, AVI. Put it on a server and then stream it to you somewhere else, that Bravo or Comcast isn't going to come after you. And by Bravo, I mean A&E. AMC.
Well, there'd be the problem of the DMCA, presumably I'm breaking some sort of copyright protection to be able to do that, right?
Possibly. I
Yeah,
mean, even
maybe,
assuming
but
that there it isn't encrypted.
assuming, sure, if it's not encrypted, I don't see why I can't do that. It's just like a VCR, right?
Well, unfortunately, this is the beauty that of the copyright and also the disaster that is the copyright, because I think what Dominic is saying is that perhaps under the exclusive rights under the Copyright Act, this might not technically be a violation. But what Ben it seems to be suggesting, and I think that I'm siding with Ben here, is that the copyright is just one part of this. There's also a license agreement which has restrictive covenants that might form the basis for a contract that restricts the other uses that might be made of a particular work. And that might be the problem that users run into when trying to stream from a service like this. Does that sound right?
Sure, but I mean, you don't see any of that when you buy an MP3 off of Amazon. There is no license agreement that I remember that last time I bought an MP3 off of Amazon. You just get the file and it's unencrypted.
There's got to be a license agreement that you agreed to at some point.
I'm looking for one right now, but I mean, I can buy an MP3 album with one click and it doesn't require me to click through to a license.
No, but when you signed up for your Amazon account, you would have been agreeing to several contracts along the way. That's where I'd bet that you'd find the actual contract terms for something like this.
Incidentally, and just as a test, I've Netflix established new terms of service recently, and I have, I don't know, it's been going on a couple of months now that I have not clicked that I agree to the terms of service, and I'm still getting uninterrupted Netflix, so I kind of want to see how long that lasts.
Well, if anyone Netflix listens to our podcast, not much longer, I'm gonna guess. Let's see, I can find a story from 2007 saying that Amazon actually, back in 2007, their license said that you may copy, store, transfer, and burn the digital content for personal use, but you agree you will not redistribute, transmit, assign, sell, broadcast, rent, share, lend, modify, adapt, edit, sublicense, or otherwise transfer or use the digital content. So that brings the question of if I bought a song off of Amazon in 2007 when that license was in effect, would I now be violating that license by streaming it on Amazon Cloud Player?
Well,
Or.
use. I was just going to point out, use the word or the term transmit in there, and so a transmission could be a lot of things, but it could also include streaming.
Right, but isn't it. I mean, it says you agree not to transmit, but it says that I may copy for personal use, and isn't streaming it off of the cloud a copy, fundamentally?
Sure, but it's also transmitting it, though.
Not necessarily. I mean, under Cablevision, a buffered copy of, a television show was not a copy under the Copyright Act.
Well,
Okay, well,
it's
certainly
not.
it's a transfer.
If you're
But
transferring it, I
transfers are
mean.
permitted.
Right, but transmissions aren't. What the heck is the difference between a transmission and a transfer?
You'd never be able to put it up into the cloud in the first place if you couldn't transmit it there.
Wouldn't that be a transfer?
Sorry, but if I copy it there, it's fine. So I can copy it to the cloud, but I can't transmit it to the cloud.
Like, it seems like these license agreements are just using verbs for the sake of using verbs without actually checking what these verbs mean.
Ah, yes, ambiguity. The law, unfortunately, a contract law at least, favors some measure of ambiguity. I mean, if a term is
I don't agree with
unclear,
that
it's
statement.
just. No, I stand by
I
that, as a
think.
matter of fact. I
No, the
think
law
that
doesn't like
if you look.
ambiguity.
Well, it doesn't like a certain type of ambiguity. You can have extremes of ambiguity, which could take a contract out so far as to not be enforceable, but within the bounds of other, like, just lesser ambiguities, I know I'm sort of mincing terms here, and this sounds very circular. You can have a measure of ambiguity with what you mean within a certain term. If you use the term transmit, what does transmit mean? Transmit could mean a bunch of things, just as I think we've decided here.
So there can be some benefit to having a license that is license or contract that is a little ambiguous, but I don't think it's fair to say that the law favors it.
Yeah,
Because
I wouldn't say.
I meant that contract law favors ambiguity. When you're writing a contract as a lawyer, people tend to, if the person who is drafting it, you tend to want some terms to be ambiguous and other terms not to be ambiguous. And
Well,
it's an art in itself.
yeah, you want the terms to be ambiguous so that you interpret them the way you want, and the other guy interprets the other guy the way the other guy wants, so that you can get an agreement and sign, and then in court you can argue that actually what the other guy agreed to was your interpretation. That's the art of contract law, that you use ambiguity as a negotiating tool, basically, to be like, oh, well, each of us will think that what we want is what we're getting, and then should it come to court in that terrible circumstance, then we'll hammer out which one. But the ambiguity isn't going to survive a court case.
Yeah, but the problem with that is if you get too far with two people thinking different things about the same contract, then you could say, oh, well, there's no meeting of the mind, so there's no actual
Yeah.
contract.
So I found Amazon's terms currently, and they basically the same they say the same sort of thing. You may store, copy, transfer, and burn the digital content only for your personal, non-commercial entertainment use. And then except as set forth in the section that I just read, you will not redistribute, transmit, assign, sell, broadcast, rent, share, lend, modify, adapt, edit, license, or otherwise transfer or use the digital content. You are not granted any synchronization, public performance, promotional use, commercial sale, resale, reproduction, or distribution rights for the digital contract. You acknowledge that the digital content embodies the intellectual property of a third person, a third party, and is protected by law. So you can copy, store, and burn, because that takes precedence. But you don't have any other rights.
Okay. I mean, I think we've argued this to the extent of our ability to argue either side of it.
Yeah, and the interesting thing here is in the Cloud Player application terms of use, they say that by using the application with your content, you are directing us to manage or play your content on your behalf. Basically, they're saying that they want to subsume, if you will, your rights. They're basically letting you use them as a tool. They're saying that Amazon itself isn't playing anything. Amazon itself isn't copying anything. Amazon itself isn't streaming anything. It's the users who have the rights to do so that are doing so, not Amazon. At least that's what they're trying to do with their Cloud Player license.
And that sounds like Cablevision, because one of the other holdings in the Cablevision case was that Cablevision was not doing the copying where it was a user on the other end of a remote who hit a, you know, red button to record, and that, you know, it was the user who was responsible for the copying. So it looks like Amazon's trying to put that up as a shield, saying, you know, we're not doing anything on our own. This is the user who's directing a service to do things, not Amazon itself.
Yeah, and if they succeed in that argument, then I think they don't need licenses.
If for as long as the license agreements with the record companies are still in force, as soon as those expire, I'm willing to bet that the record companies then will want to change the terms if they want to go back into another agreement with Amazon. And then we run into this problem all over again.
Selling the MP3s in the first place?
Sure, they would renegotiate the terms of the contract with Amazon. We're not going to provide you these MP3s unless you agree to pay us more royalties if you're going to use a cloud streaming service.
At this point, I think whoever the major competitor is to iTunes has almost as much market power as iTunes in leveraging terms in these contracts, because the only thing that the record companies would like less than... I lost where I was going with that sentence. The idea is they want competition to iTunes. They don't want iTunes to be the only game in town.
I think Amazon is the biggest competition to iTunes, right?
That's correct. Well,
I mean, out of all the MP3s I've bought, I've only bought MP3s from two places online, iTunes and Amazon.
Right. The biggest competition to iTunes is probably technically Walmart, but the biggest online competition is Amazon, as far as I know.
Yeah, so we'll just have to see what comes of this, I guess. I mean, we'll see like what the record companies think of it, and if lawsuits do in fact get filed, that will probably tell us one way or another. Or it might just tell us that there are issues in the contracts.
Yeah, I'm going to be bold and predict that Amazon is going to prove victorious in this and not require any licenses. Because, I mean, the record companies are afraid, basically, that if we have these sort of cloud lockers, people are going to use them for piracy, which is just not true. Like, the vast majority of use, talking about statistics that I have absolutely no basis here, just making up statistics, the vast majority of use, I believe, is perfectly legit. People are streaming their own songs, streaming their CDs, use cases like mine. I rip my CDs, put them on my Dropbox so they can play them on my iPod, iPhone, whenever, without having to preload them onto my iPhone, because I sync that thing less and less. Or perhaps I'm at a work machine and I want to sync my music folder of Dropbox so I can get my music that way. Like, the vast majority of people are not doing massive piracy on their cloud-based storage service.
Okay, any last thoughts on this story, David?
I'm not entirely convinced that Amazon is free of guilt here, but I'm going to hold my opinion for now and just wait and see what happens in a few months.
Dominic?
All set?
Okay, take it away.
Sure, our last story is kind of sad. Caroline Wimmer, a 26-year-old, was strangled with a hairdryer cord in March 2009. The paramedic who responded to the call actually took a picture of her corpse and uploaded it to Facebook. Why, I have no idea, but nonetheless, he did. Her parents are now suing Facebook to try to get the picture. The paramedic obviously removed the photo soon after, and the parents want Facebook to basically find and destroy all copies of this photo. They're also suing the paramedic, but I think the interesting angle for the technical legal crew here is the suit against Facebook. Because Facebook has backup servers, presumably, and so they probably have a digital copy of the image somewhere. I guess we can start with our panel. Does the Communications Decency Act, in other words, the shield that enables third-party uploaders to be responsible, and thus Facebook isn't even responsible in this case, does that protect here?
Almost unquestionably, it would protect Facebook from a lawsuit like this, because the person who actually uploaded it is the person who is at fault. That's the paramedic. And Facebook then doesn't have any particular liability for what he did when he uploaded the photo. Which is kind of what makes this story so interesting, and it's too bad that the facts have to be so bad to it. But I think that my understanding from all the news stories that I've read, and I have not actually seen the complaint yet, is that the parents who filed this lawsuit were, and their lawyers were, aware of the Communications Decency Act and the fact that it would likely protect Facebook. And this seems to have sparked some discussion across some of the major news outlets, including CNN, about whether the Communications Decency Act is actually a good thing.
And I certainly understand the parents' desire to have the image destroyed, that no one can see it. Unfortunately, I'm just not clear how it can be done. It's sort of like, I remember in an unrelated vein, we had, I think, the Defense Department say that all copies of these documents must be destroyed, take them back from the internet, and you just can't take stuff back. It doesn't, like, there's no way to, for sure, get everything deleted. I mean, it's off Facebook and has been. Go ahead, Ben.
I mean, yeah, what they're seeking is, you know, through a suit against Facebook to find all of these third parties who may have downloaded it, and then to, you know, kind of go against each of those third parties individually and try to get them to, you know, forfeit any copies of the image that they have. But, I mean, one, it's not practical. Two, you're suing the wrong party. You want to be suing the individuals and then subpoena Facebook for that information. You know, again, I think Facebook would fight that. And even if you could get that information, I think the parties would have, you know, a decent argument that there's no reason why they should have to delete it. I mean, legally, morally, yes, there's, you know, obviously no reason why they should have that image. But, you know, under what theory do you, you know, force them to turn over those? You know, it's not violation of copyright because the copyright isn't owned by the parents. It's owned by the paramedic, if there is a copyright in the image at all.
Right, so this is a crime scene photo, which makes it a little bit unique. I think that some states have laws which protect the republication of crime scene photos for various reasons, like due process rights for the defendants in the criminal sides of the cases and stuff.
Right, but does that protect photos of crime scenes or photos taken by state workers of crime scenes? Because it doesn't sound like this was an official crime scene photo. It seems like this was a photo that some guy just took.
Well, how different is it, though? I mean, if we deem it a crime scene photo because it's been taken by a police officer, it's a corpse, and if it's by the paramedic, it's still a corpse, and it has its own problems associated with republication.
I think there are First Amendment issues if you suddenly start saying that people, one, cannot take pictures of crime scenes, you know, assuming it's a public street, they have access to it, and two, if the people who do take pictures can't then transmit, publish, you know, do what the First Amendment protects them to do with the images that they lawfully took.
Yep, and I absolutely think you're right. I think that they control the circumstances under which they are published sometimes. It's not that you can't take them or that they are illegal to take, but I think that some states' laws, and I don't know any in particular, can govern how those photos then are republished and whether they're republished before the trial and after the trial. And my next point was actually going to be that I think that the person who was accused of murdering this young girl has already been convicted at this point, and I think he's already serving a sentence on it.
Yeah, it's a 25-year sentence that he's currently serving.
And so the other interesting part, though, is that I think the paramedic's account is already either deactivated or the photo is completely gone from public view at this point. So we're mostly talking about where it might be residing on Facebook's backup servers or however they're managing photos that get uploaded. And I think, as you mentioned, Ben, or maybe it was you, Dominic, whoever has viewed and thus had the ability to download the photo locally on their machines.
Yeah, I also want to say that, we're taking a fairly sterile legal view of this, and I'm not unsympathetic to the parents, but at the same time, the chilling effect, God, I don't know, even know if chilling effect's the right word, but the imagine if every time you viewed a photo on Facebook, there was a chance that someone could get your information from Facebook and then sue you for viewing that photo. That's disturbing, to say the least.
It is, and that was at least in part one of the purposes of the Communications Decency Act was to ensure that there weren't kind of anti-expression or free speech lawsuits where people were sued because they had published something, and rather than allowing for discourse in a comment section, for instance, on a blog, if website operators are constantly worried about defamation suits, regardless of their merit, they might not have those comment sections open at all and not let anybody talk about things online. I guess my point is that there are real reasons, real policy reasons why this the Good Samaritan provision of the Communications Decency Act is a good thing. Unfortunately, this seems to be part of the fallout, and that's if you do in fact sue the right person eventually, let's say that the paramedic in this case was sued for some sort of invasion of privacy claim, something along those lines, and the suit was successful. Course, completely hypothetical. Let's say that the photo was still up on Facebook. It's difficult, I've been told in practice, to get judgments against enforced against third parties who weren't parties to the lawsuit. And it's conceivably difficult to have a judge exercise jurisdiction then over Facebook to get them to remove the photograph that's still being hosted on the website. And that's what people point to as being the problem in the Communications Decency Act, because it doesn't have like a notice and takedown like provision like the DMCA has for copyrighted materials.
But God, what a disaster the CDA would be if it had a notice and takedown. If every time there was something that was defamatory, somebody sends a notice and takedown and it has to be taken down, and then there's an opportunity for counter notice, that would be a huge mess.
I mean, that also seems antithetical to the point of the Communications Decency Act, at least when it was enacted. So I don't know that that necessarily accomplishes the right result to balance those interests, but I've heard some people suggest that that's what the statute should have.
So, I think we all agree that they're probably not going to meet with success in this story.
Agree.
Yeah, most likely not. I think the other thing I saw in some of these news articles was that they were trying to enforce some of the provisions of the terms of service against Facebook, which there are some prohibitions on the types of photos you can upload in Facebook, and I don't know the specific language that they use to describe what is a permissible photograph and what is not, but I think that the argument there is that this is such an egregious photograph. It has no place in Facebook to begin with, so I don't know how that squares out in court in terms of this family getting the all copies of the photo completely deleted from Facebook, but that is the other angle they're taking this from.
Right, and then the problem is, are the parents a third-party beneficiary of the contract that Facebook has with, the people who have uploaded and viewed that, such that they could get Facebook to act on their contract with other people? And, that's a stretch.
Yeah, those are the types of issues actually that I don't think have been litigated almost at all. There might be like just a handful of cases about those types of terms of service agreements and how it might affect other users or third-party beneficiaries.
Any other thoughts on this story?
I think that's it.
Yep, all set.
Right. Well, in that case, thank you to listening. Thank you for listening to this episode of Technically Legal. I'm Dominic Rabia.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Please visit our website at technicallylegal.org. If you have any thoughts, ideas, comments, or questions, feel free to email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @techlegal. Have a great week.